The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, where we discuss current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep current on the news from China with a daily email newsletter or a cool little smartphone app. Go to subchina.com to subscribe or download the app from iTunes or from Google Play. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I am Kaiser Guo, and I am coming to you today from some guy's Airbnb on the Upper West Side, where we've established a makeshift headquarters for Seneca. And I am joined here not only by Jeremy Goldcorn, my usual partner in crime, but also sitting next to him, oh my God, his beautiful lady wife.
Lady wife.
Is that kind of like a lady man? Yeah. Wife. A lady boy, sorry.
Hey, lady wife. Of course, you cynical listeners all have heard about Wufei, who Jeremy can't just shut up about. But you guys will see why soon, right? And not only that, but we are also joined by Abigail Washburn, the Empress of the Banjo. That is her epithet.
Grammy Award winning
right. Empress of the Banjo. Grammy Award winning Empress of the Banjo. We're incredibly psyched because they're playing a gig here tomorrow night here in New York. Jeremy and I happen to be up here in town. And they are, not only they have their instruments before them, they're going to be playing some live, some tunes for you guys to enjoy. It's amazing stuff. But let's plunge right in and let's get the superhero origin stories for these two. Yeah? Okay, let's start with you.
We speak in music, Kaiser.
Yeah. Okay. It's the universal language, man. It's the universal language. Wufei, why did you marry this guy? Seriously. I'm a musician.
Let's not answer that question.
I knew it could not be a musician.
Right. Oh, that's.
Yeah. And I knew it had to be someone crazy as me.
Okay. Right. There we go. Seriously, but you're a Beijinger. You're a Beijinger, and you were educated at the conservatory here. You went to, you know, Bao Jia Jie Si Shi Er Hao. Okay, so yeah, you can speak English. This is an English podcast.
Right. Hey, well, yeah, it's at the China Conservatory of Music in Prince Gong's Palace for 3 years.
Oh, right.
In high school part.
Oh, okay.
Well, they have moved it away a few years ago, but when I was in high school, we were in there.
It sounded magical, the stories that Faye has of being in Prince Gong's Palace studying, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine it would inspire you to play some serious guzheng.
I didn't study guzheng performance there. I studied composition.
Oh, okay.
And it was quite a trippy experience studying in the Prince Gong's Palace.
Do you come from a musical family? Are your parents both musical?
I would say yes. Not my dad plays the sanxiar, the three-string fretless, I would say Chinese banjo. Sounds quite similar.
Except totally dead in tone, right? It's like the toothless old codger instrument. Yeah, or the courtesans in old Beijing.
It's a very fun toothless old codger.
She looks great without teeth, actually. That's why Jeremy.
Right. The sanxian, you guys are familiar with. It's a three-string. It's usually got sort of a python or a snake skin. Over the soundboard. And it's got an incredibly long neck. And what I always found difficult about it is just in the first position, stretches are amazing. It's like you have to have like Rachmaninoff hands to play.
Got to have a super long pinky.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's just a crazy long intervals, right? I mean, just like...
But I play the Xiao Sanxiar.
Oh,
my dad,
okay.
Yeah, gave me a gift. It's a Xiao Sanxiar. He plays the big one.
The small one.
The small version, yeah. Right. And he's a musician. He's incredibly talented. Although their time when they were young, it was in the middle of the Cultural Revolution, so they didn't have any chance or opportunity to pursue their dreams. Therefore, I got to do it for them. I hated it when I was a kid, but now I went through some ups and downs and had some breakthroughs, and I'm completely in love with it.
You hear that, kids? You hear that?
Faye, maybe you can start, you know, being married to, I know some of the backstory. I mean, you actually started playing when you were maybe 5 or 6. Nobody in your family actually remembers exactly when, but let's say 6, right?
Yeah.
So how did that happen? How did your parents force you to start playing guzheng at that age?
My dad actually told me when he went to his sanxia teacher's troupe, tuan. In China, the professional performance troupes are always a state-owned company. And he went to his sanxia teacher's practice, and he saw them making an earning from just rehearsing music all day long. So he said, wow, that's a nice life. And
that's the way you do it.
Right. I was like, I certainly can't, you know, do this, but I want my daughter to do this. At the time, I was 3. And then he basically decided, and he saw music talent in me. I don't know how. And then he, from then, started searching music instrument teachers for me until I officially started taking lessons from a professor from China Conservatory of Music on the guzheng.
Wow.
He wanted me to study sanxia at the beginning, but they said I didn't like it, so they had to choose something else.
So did you when you were studying composition, presumably you also learned piano? And
Yes. I had to learn the piano since I was like 8, because my music guzheng teacher said, okay, this kid has a lot of talent. She should study solfège and ear training in the conservatory, on the conservatory's weekend school every Saturday. And in order to do that, I have to have a piano at home and knowing how to read Western scores and studying music theory. So that's how I started the piano. And then later, more teachers told my parents that Faye should pursue more in the composition approach, because just somehow they also saw different talent. So I had to go through this pretty intense tests, exams for prepared for the test for about a year, and then a 2-week-long exams, like multiple exams for 2 weeks, and finally got in to the conservatory high school when I was 16 years old.
Wow. So now I know that, like, when you study art in China, you can either kind of go with the Youhua, the Western style art track, or you can do the Guohua track.
Mm.
Now with music, the Chinese and Western musical traditions are very divergent. They're very, very different, although we're going to see shortly how they can be beautifully synthesized. But they are very different. And so were you studying specifically Western music, and how did that square with your learning a traditional classical Chinese instrument that was, you know, in this case, one that is like pentatonic by design? It's just written into the fact that that's how a guzheng is tuned.
I studied pretty much, I would say 90% of the subjects in the composition department in China Conservatory were Western classical music.
90%.
We had very little Chinese music education. Most of my Chinese traditional music education came from learning the guzheng from my professors before I entered the conservatory, and from my own family. So, yeah, as a composition student, we studied basically the Russian school, the French school, European, you know, from medieval time to all the way contemporary Stravinsky and John Cage. That was what I was taught. And I felt at the time quite uncool to play a Chinese traditional instrument. So I did not touch my guzheng for solid, I would say, 5 years. Because I thought, oh, I'm going to be a pianist. I don't want to be a guzheng player because, you know, traditional Chinese instruments were not considered as cool. So I did not touch it a bit until I came to the States.
So your story, we'll pick it up from where you go to the States, but I want to contrast it right now with Abby's, which is so different because you were just telling me that you didn't start playing banjo until you were 21 years old.
Right. Yes. I grew up in a home that really didn't have much music. I mean, we had a record player and we had like 5 records, including Whitney Houston. I believe the children are future. I was super into that. She's so awesome. I want to dance with somebody. So I was really into, like, you know, stuff I heard on the radio.
With somebody
who was. Wow. And Richard Marx, you know, that kind of stuff.
Oh, my God.
But
really high class stuff.
Some real great Richard pop Marx, music. Yeah. From the time.
That connected you to China then, because Richard Marx was a big deeply. Big yeah. I mean, that's the other strange part of your story. I mean, because for those of you who don't know, Abigail lived in Beijing on and off for many, many years. I used to see you playing all the time, and I mean, she was fantastic, of course. And one of her things was, I mean, she was a fluent Mandarin speaker. And yeah. We'll get into the whole China connection in a bit, but go on, please.
So yeah, I just didn't grow up with much music in my house. My brother, when he got into high school, started playing rock guitar. He got really into Joe Satriani and Van Halen. So I would hear, like, him with the amp down and the V guitar.
Oh yeah,
down in the basement, yeah. Like right. The flying V, just going after it, you know. But I wasn't really drawn to it. I did play piano and recorder when I was little, and I was always very good at the piano right away because I could hear what somebody played and play it back to them. But my first teacher I had wouldn't let me do that.
Right.
Because you wanted me to read. And so I lost interest.
Actually, that's what I did.
Yeah.
I faked knowing how to read
right.
The whole time.
Yeah.
I mean, I would pretend I was reading, but I was just playing by ear.
Yeah. And I so enjoyed it when I was allowed to play by ear. But when I was forced to read, I just didn't do it. I didn't want to do it. So my mom was fine with that. So I only did, you know, a little bit of music for 2 years. I always sang in choir. I always loved that. I'd try out for the solos and I'd never get them. So I just didn't figure I was much of a musician.
You should go wave your Grammy in their face now.
That's a whole journey of circumstance and luck and hard work that is, it seems unrelated to all that. But when I got to college, I did start dating someone who was a bluegrass musician, and Bo Stapleton is his name. And so I learned about bluegrass through him in college, and I actually met him on a trip to China. He was on the same trip, my first time going to China, when we were both, I guess, 18 or 19 years old. We spent a summer over there with a couple of kids from Colorado College, and that's when he and I met, and he introduced me to bluegrass music soon thereafter. Again, it wasn't my thing. I felt very dedicated to China from the moment I went over there for the first time, and not that interested in bluegrass music, but I would still sell merch at their shows, and sometimes I'd sing like backup if they needed it, you know? But as I got deeper and deeper into the China, into loving China and understanding the lack of knowledge of most Americans about China, I mean, I remember the first time I came back from China, or I think it was the second time, actually, and I'd spent 6 months in Sichuan province and felt at that point deeply immersed and in love with Chinese culture. And I came back, and one of my relatives from southern Minnesota called me and said, they called and they said, Abigail, how was Japan?
That's a good accent.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I mean, it wasn't just that. It was so many different things. Watching the news, everything, the way I'd interact with people, and they just didn't think of anything other than Asia or the Orient as one big chunk. This is back in the early 90s, you know? Mm-hmm. I knew there was a need, and I felt that I could serve somehow to help Americans understand China a little better.
Sorry, Abby, we kind of glossed over. So how did you first go to China? What was the impetus?
Yeah, how
did
you get interested in China? So you were at Colorado College, which is that school where they don't give grades and you take like one class for a year. is that right?
Well, it was a little bit of an overstatement you just made. You do actually take 8 classes in a year, but you take one class at a time. It's called the block plan.
Oh, right.
So you take one class for 3.5 weeks and then you get 4 days off.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
And then you come back and you just do one thing very intensively at a time.
Oh, that's great.
And so they had a 2-block class in the summer that was 7 weeks long. And you do get grades. You get grades like everybody. No, I think you're thinking of that place in Olympia, Washington that
maybe,
has like,
yeah.
You know, Evergreen or something like that.
Yeah. Evergreen.
Or I can't remember
Reed
what it's called.
Or
yeah. No, they get grades. Yeah. Well, okay. I know what you're talking about, though. So I saw a sign that said study Chinese in China. And that was at the end of my freshman year. And I was just interested. And I had studied French in high school and gone to France. I didn't need to keep pursuing that. And I wanted to do something really different. And I kind of wanted to just go really far away and see what the other side of the world was like. And so I did. And I had the luxury of doing that, you know, to be able to be a liberal arts student that could go check all this stuff out. And so I did. And truthfully, the first time I went to China, I didn't like it that much, which is
It's par for the course. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think most people end up actually really loving China when they first go, don't like it that much. I mean, I was the same. That could
be. You were the same too? Really?
I hated it the first year I was there, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, I thought Chinese people were totally crazy.
Yeah.
Maybe true.
this is coming from you.
It took me about a year. A year of hate before the love came.
Were you in Beijing?
Yeah.
And I was in... Shanghai for the for 4 weeks of that, and then saw a little bit of Chufu and Beijing and Hong Kong, and it was just dirty and it was sweaty and hot. It was the height of summer and yeah. People were all Shanghai. Up in my grill all the time, right. You know, the only interaction I had with Chinese people was them trying to sell me stuff, and I was terrible at Chinese. I was just learning Chinese, so I really couldn't talk to anybody, and the only people who would talk to me were like people who were trying to practice their English. I'd come back to my dorm room after I was in class and stuff would be rearranged, people had gone through my stuff, you know.
So it was like all those so uncomfortable. How did you evolve out of that? I mean, that seems like a pretty dismal experience.
Well, it was kind of rough.
Yeah.
Well, I came back to the States, and the contrast, you know, you guys have all felt it in one way or another. You get off the plane, things are spacious, things are clean. There's a little something missing though.
Right.
And for the rest of your life, there will always be a little something missing because you went to China. And I did think, okay, good riddance. I'm probably never going to go back there. I'm going to pursue something else in school. But I have these pictures of Gandhi, or I did in high school, Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. and the United Nations mural on my wall. I'm a real geek. So like in high school,
that's lovely though.
In high school, instead of going to my senior prom, I went to the United Nations Disarmament Conference in Winnipeg, Canada. And I'm that kind of kid, you know?
Excellent.
And so I was there, and I'd wake up every morning, I'd look up and I'd see Gandhi and MLK, and I was trying to reconcile this experience and these feelings I had when I was in China. And I just knew. I felt like Gandhi was like staring at me. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I'm like disenchanted with 1.3 billion people on the face of the planet, and that's not okay. Right. And I have to figure that out. So I went back. And I went back a semester later, and I went to Sichuan province to the Keji Dashue at the time. Now it was the technical university. Now it's one university. And I met an amazing woman by chance. And that's a fun story too, but I don't think we have time. And I met her on the street, and she invited me over for dumplings. And she was an old lady, 80 years old.
Oh, lovely.
Cataracts, little silver hair, bob. She shuffled down the street. She was about 4 feet tall. And she took me in, and I spent 3 days a week with her for that 6 months. And she'd feed me. I'd gained 20 pounds. I gained 20 pounds. I got off the airplane when I got back to the States. My parents were like, what did you guys do with our daughter? She's huge. It was all Lao Wang's. Dumplings, Sichuan dumplings.
Oh yeah, those will do it to you.
So I fell in love. The second time I went, I fell in love, and that was that. And I knew I had to spend the rest of my life. I felt married to China after that. I had to spend the rest of my life figuring out how to help Americans and Chinese know each other better, because those secrets, those special emotional intimate places that we have, are hard to reach with each other unless you speak the language.
You guys have kind of parallel stories in a way, because, you know, you've both kind of tried to wed Chinese and American music in different ways, you know, coming from different directions, mm-hmm. but meeting at a really, I mean, a pretty magical place, right? Tell us about you came to the States for after graduating from the conservatory, right?
No, in the mid, I transferred from China Conservatory of Music to music college at University of North Texas.
Oh, North Texas, right.
Yeah, they have a very big and quite a renowned music program. And so I got a scholarship, and I was, oh, this is where I'm going. They, you know, it's nice. But and then it was still in the kind of a music conservatory setting, so it wasn't super different. But the thing that really changed my life was for the first time seeing African drumming ensemble and Indian raga singers.
Wow.
So I was like, oh my goodness. And their marching band, because UND has like the country's top level marching bands. I was just blown away by the music that I had no clue, like never saw anything like that in my life.
I never would have guessed that marching bands had played a role.
Right? Marching band. Oh, they were amazing they're drummers. Amazing, yeah. They were like practice. Texas is hot. They were like practice outside on the like concrete. Like eight guys. I would just seeing the shadow of their drumsticks, like, and then they have all sorts of patterns, combinations. You know, they're just amazing percussionists.
Wow.
So I had a blast. And then after that, I went to Mills also by a total chance. Like chance, I did not plan to go to a nest of avant-garde composer school.
So you, how long were you at UNT for, Faye?
For 2 years.
And then you graduated and
with a music bachelor's.
And you went to Mills College
for a graduate master's degree.
And Mills is in Oakland, California, near San Francisco, right?
Yeah.
And tell us about Mills, because it's kind of a special place. I mean, there's a certain kind of music that comes out of Mills, right?
Yes. At the time when I applied, I didn't know that much about Mills' legacy in the avant-garde, like contemporary American avant-garde music scene. I just thought I needed to go to get a master's degree somewhere and a famous music, you know, as a Chinese student, that's all you think of. And then I met this composer, Frederick Zhevsky, in Cincinnati Conservatory during a music festival. He recommended Mills. So I was like, oh, and then I started checking out other schools like Manhattan School of Music. And then I saw the website of Mills Campus and saw, oh, California. Oh my goodness, it's so beautiful. I want to go there. I checked out. Well, like, obviously they're good because otherwise this famous professor wouldn't recommend it. So I just applied and they accepted me. And so when I went there, I realized, wow, like it was associated with so many revolutionary composer in the contemporary like music history, basically John Cage.
You were familiar with Cage. I mean, you just
I was familiar with the name, okay. Not so much of the work and
the
influence.
Pianos,
yeah, I knew who. I mean, it's like his famous, you know, not playing anything for four minutes and 33 seconds. But and then I really started studying about Cage's work from when he was young, and then the progression, the development as a composer from when he's young to where he like revolutionized the concept. And then I started to have a deeper understanding of why he did it. And
at this point, was the seed already in you to think about combining somehow Chinese traditional music in some way with
Western avant-garde? Yes, I actually had started doing that even when I was in China, putting Chinese instruments with Western instruments together, writing music like that. But only for, well, there's some kind of curiosity of combining the sound, the result, but not still kind of trying to find my voice. Mm. You know, I was only like, you know, 18 or not knowing what I was doing, just trying to pile up a bunch new sounds together. But at Mills, I started to have more understanding, and I had the wake up call to me to really change that. The moment that changed my life was when I had my first lesson with Fred Frith.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
Fred Frith.
Yeah, he was my main teacher at Mills for 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I went to Fred's office and
sorry to interrupt. Maybe you can explain who Fred Frith is, because
Fred Frith is a
guitarist primarily.
He's a guitarist, and he also played bass in this avant rock noise band called Massacre and Naked City that was in the 1970s, were active in the 70s and 80s with Bill Frisell, John Zorn, who else? He collaborated a lot with Mike Patton on Faith No More.
Mm-hmm.
Mr.
Bungle, right?
Yeah, Mr. Bungle, yes. And also Fred collaborated with Bjork, Brian Eno.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So just like, you know, Amelo pushing sort of other musicians in their genres. So Fred, I still had no clue who he was, even when I was learning from him at the beginning. But he asked me the first lesson to bring my recordings, my old compositions. So he wanted to take a listen. And after listening to a bunch, and he said, Faye, I hear a lot of amazing craft, but I don't hear Faye. And at that moment, I just, like, I felt like a hammer, like a 5-ton hammer on my brain. Whang! I was like, holy camoli, what have I been doing in 22 years in my life and not knowing why I do music? And I thought I was, like, you know, writing the next Chopin piece and all that. But now it's like, oh, I guess they're all nonsense. So I just had to go home and just kind of be one, just like shut the door and think for like 10 days. And so Fred just pushed me, said, you just got to cut it clean. You know, you will never lose the craft, but you need to cut it
transcend
out of
it.
Yeah, you need to start just let it loose and let yourself out. And don't worry about anything. Just let it flow out of your heart and your brain, whatever. Don't control it. That's when I started to go kind of crazy and never stopped. Because it's too much fun.
Right. Abby, you encountered Chinese music when you were in China in the early 90s and then beyond. What was your initial impression of it?
This is going to sound so strange, but I wasn't much of a musical thinker at the time. So even though I liked it, I wasn't going there to, you know, to listen to music. I had a really neat experience in the, what is it called? The Sanwei Shudian.
Yeah, Sanwei Shudian. Yeah.
I had a bunch of wonderful experiences there, and I ended up getting to play a show there, which was like my dream come true.
Legendary bookstore in Western Beijing.
Yeah. Is it still there?
It is.
Wow.
It was... it got shut down for a little while.
I don't actually know if it's still open.
I think it reopened. Oh, I'm pretty sure it reopened.
A place where they often have very interesting talks and music occasionally and tea.
Yeah. So I started being really introduced to the music there, and I would go. This was when I was a consultant working at a consultancy as an intern, APCO
in Beijing. Oh, you worked at APCO.
Yeah, for 6 months. And so on the weekends and a lot, I would end up at Sanwei Shudian to see music, and they'd have little puppet shows there sometimes and things. And that's when I think I started really having a love affair with Chinese music and the way that nature and, so much space in the music, so much space compared to most of the things I've heard growing up in America. So that's where my love affair of Chinese music probably started. Also, when I was in Sichuan, I loved going down to the, there was a Lao Ren,
old persons, those are retirees,
kind of. Yeah, Tui
Xiu Ren, the
But
it was literally Sichuan Opera for old folks.
Yeah. The Senior Citizens Activity Center. Sichuan Opera specifically for old folks.
Specifically Sichuan Opera. It was just a stage and a little area, and there were these little bamboo chairs, and everybody ate their sunflower seeds and peed in their pants and drank tea. And I did start to fall in love with Chinese music there, even though it sounded cray balls. You know, that music is just
crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cray balls.
So let's hear what fruit that love affair bore. I think it's time to hear from you two. Let's hear a musical number. Introduce the first song you're going to play for us, and tell us a little bit about the piece.
We'll start with an instrumental piece, so you can just hear our two instruments interacting.
Okay, we'll leave the lovely voices for later.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'll play it. Two tunes. One, both of them come from North Carolina. The first one comes is called Julian Johnson, but there are two very popular versions of Julian Johnson from North Carolina. One comes from the mountains, and one comes from the coast. This one is from the coast, and the next tune after that I'm going to play is Backstep Cindy, and Faye is going to play some tunes from China at the very same time, and you'll get to see how it all works out.
Yeah.
And so what do we call this composition? I mean, it's just, is there a sort of a slash?
Because the
Julian
Chinese
Johnson
tunes,
slash.
Actually, the Chinese tunes I'll play with Abby. The beginning one is from Guangdong. Uh-huh. It's called the Fang Zhi Mang, Busy Weaving. And the next one is from Henan province. It's called 小开手, little okay.
So
open hand.
I get North Carolina and Henan in one song.
Right. And Guangdong.
Yeah. And Guangdong.
And Guangdong.
That's a scary combination.
So we call it Cindy's little hand.
Cindy's little hand. Backstep Cindy and open little hand combined.
Let's hear it. Thank you so much. That was amazing. Jeremy, you are really a lucky guy. I mean, you get to hear this all the time.
Not all the time, but quite a lot of the time. You know, Abby's busy, so she's not always performing with Faye, but they're working on a lot of stuff, so hopefully more frequently in the next few months.
But we do have to thank Jeremy very much. Just this last week, he was taking care of both Felix and Vivi, the little ones, so that Faye and I could rehearse.
Good.
Yeah.
Good man,
He's
Jeremy.
He's a good man. He's a good man.
Yeah.
Hey, so...
they say
I guess
so.
I have a sort of theory question. I mean, so how did it occur to you that Americana would work with pentatonic-based Chinese folk music? I mean, whose idea? How did this come into your heads, and how did this collision occur? I mean, it's amazing.
I just did not even think like that.
No,
it just came from friendship first. Like, you know, if you love someone, you trust someone so much, something good will happen.
But I mean, it sounds like they were written to be played on top of one another almost. I mean,
it's also, I think, from both Abby and I, our knowledge in our folk music, that's definitely, you know, we've put the time and the study and the passion into it. But on top of that, a lot of people, musicians, know the same knowledge and haven't come up with this kind of collaborations. So I think it's just our respect and passion for each other. So it's kind of hard to explain. It's we don't think about, oh, is it like this G pentatonic? Would that work on the, you know, if bend the banjo? We're like, we never.
Really?
We never work like that.
No.
No. Wow. It would sound pretty bad, way I think, if organic. We have to force ourselves that way.
Yeah, we just sit together and sing each other songs, you know? I mean, I remember Jeremy was telling me there was a time, you know, Jeremy, it's so beautiful just to like sit there and hear Faye just sing old folk songs, you know, and it's magical. And that's how I feel. I mean, that's why I was drawn into the music, was hearing people just sit around and sing each other beautiful old songs that made me cry. And I heard Doc Watson. That's what I heard. I heard a recording of Doc Watson at a party, and I when I was about 21, and I went out and I bought a banjo and I started playing it, but I never suspected I'd do like this kind of stuff. I thought I was still going to go to China and do something practical with my life.
Were you self-taught on banjo, or did you
well, kind of. I've had some mentors though, you know. Yeah. Like a guy named Riley Bogus out of Walkertown, North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
Had a big influence on how I play in particular. But no, just listening to music a lot and listening to people around me play music. I mean, in America, we have all these folk festivals all over the place. Right. And you can go just live in the dirt for a weekend and just listen to music and play music with people all weekend. And it's magical. And the first time people ask me this a lot, they were like, how did you think to like put Chinese and American folk music together? And for me, it was very simple. I started playing the banjo after I fell in love with China and Chinese culture. So when I started playing the banjo, one of the first things I wanted to do was translate old folk songs into Chinese and sing them for the people when I went back to China. So it was for love and fun and passion. And I thought, oh, this is something culturally interesting and relevant that I can share with my Chinese friends and people I meet over here. It's something beautiful about America I can share with people. So that's why I did it.
And Abby, can I ask, One of the, you know, when Faye and I were first together, she used to sing Chinese folk songs. Some of them I'd actually heard on the TV or the radio in China, but usually I thought they were horrible because it was this like very overproduced.
Yeah, the arrangements
style.
Were bad.
Arrangements very bad. And they always seemed to be trying to imitate Western opera. So that, you know, there was a very pretty folk song, but suddenly it was like, whoa. You know, yeah. There was this kind of ridiculous sort of kitschy way of doing it. And to realize that the songs themselves are just very good. There are these beautiful, beautiful folk songs. I mean, how did you sort of get
just
drawn into that?
Some people
how did you
past
see
them.
Past the awful kind of Peng Liyuan-ification of Chinese
well,
music?
Well, I got to meet amazing people playing music, even the first time I came to Beijing to play music. Specifically to play music. When I decided, okay, I'm not going to go to Beijing University, I'm going to stay in Nashville and make music, my friends called right away, like John Campbell, and said, you've got to come over here and come back to Beijing and play some bars. I'll set up some gigs for you, you know? And so I did. And I was like, I played Nashville Bar in Assembly Twin back in the day.
I know where that
you know?
Is.
The old Nashville, yeah, on South Bar Street. Yeah.
It's still going, actually, you know, north of Chaoyang Park.
Is it really?
Yeah. It's on Yurenjie now.
Yeah. And because of that and doing a few other things, I had friends because I had been at APCO and had built some really dear friendships in Beijing. So I immediately had, you know, 30 people who would come see me play this weird music I'd seemed to have adapted since the last time I lived in China. And it just worked. It really worked. And I have to say, I got to really like develop my solo show and my artistry a lot in China. It was a huge piece of me becoming a musician here in the United States. I felt like I could take chances in China because there weren't like industry people watching me and nobody really cared what came out of my mouth. It was really powerful to be able to do those shows in China.
That's that's a great insight. I've met people who feel that way too. They don't feel constrained.
Yeah.
I mean, they feel like I can reinvent myself. I can try things. I can do things.
You are such a person. <that you've met. laughs>
I wasn't going to say anything.
I also wanted to mention some of the really cool musicians I got to meet right away when I was first there. So there was a band that I loved when I was in China that I'd heard about even when I was back in Sichuan called Ye Haize. And
I went
to their shows and just loved it and was really drawn to the way they were combining like contemporary sounds and
the Xibei Feng.
Yeah, the Xibei Feng with like what they love. And
it was basically folk music from
the
northwestern
China. Those dudes were from
China.
Lanzhou or something, right? Or
Gansu and Shanxi, basically. Right?
They have the best folk songs
ever.
So good.
In in my view, out of all the other
in Han
folks,
China.
Yeah,
and they
China.
Were like a bar band. They would like play bars and I would go see them. And then the first time I got to jam with people in Beijing, it was like Mamuar and Hangai and the old Hangai.
Yeah,
and Hangai we'd have is... jam circles. We'd go out to Mamuar's house, like way out in, what's it called?
Now Sundrong
it's
not, or something.
The last stop on the line that goes south.
Oh, wow. That's what.
Yizhuang, Fengtai.
Anyway, well, I don't know.
Let's just guess.
I can't remember now. But so we'd go way out into the, you know, the way out suburbs and just jam in Mamuar's little house and
playing the Mongolian stuff.
Right? Yeah, Mongolian, and his was the Shibe stuff and the Kazakh Chinese. And I felt like there was a scene. But what I found out was that was like the only scene.
Right. It's the one scene.
The great one scene. And as I traveled, like at the little bar in Sichuan and Chengdu, I got to meet really wonderful musicians through them also. And then on a more official level, all of the tours I've done in China that are official and I play a university, I always ask to collaborate with somebody. So I've gotten to play with amazing musicians all over China because of touring all over China.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
But Faye is my favorite.
So let's hear something let's hear something with a little vocal action going on here because you guys blend so beautifully. What's the next song you're going to play for us?
The next one is called The Water is Wide, an Usuli Boat Song. The one that I sing in this one is called the Usuli Chuange. It's actually a very famous folk song in China. However, the version that I grew up, or most Chinese grew up knowing, is the lyrics are added to the melody by this famous singer who made the song famous in the 1950s, mm-hmm. and is about praising the socialist.
Praising Mao,
exactly. I did not know about that until I start digging up more, because from the experience of other songs that I just had to, you know, investigate more. And then I did find out it's actually He Zhe, the ethnic group near Usuli River.
In the northeastern part of China.
Yeah.
Heilongjiang province, right?
Yes. Basically at the border between Russia and China. So 2/3 of Usuli people live on the Russian side, and then the other live on China's side. So this one, their song has become the most beloved and famous popular folk song in China. So this is the Usuli Boat Song. And Abby's song
is called The Water is Wide. And any of you who are, well, a lot of you probably know this song. It's of Scotch-Irish origin. Mm-hmm. It's old. And I took one verse from it that seemed to fit what Faye and I were singing about. We're new mothers. We're learning how to do this, and we have a deep love affair with our children. And so this is why I chose the verse that I did.
And they're both sort of, you know, riparian songs, right? They're both about water.
Something as somebody's, you know, listened to
y'all
sing this together a number of times. What I always find interesting is that the Usuli Boat Song is about the joy of being on the river and the length of the river and how you can go places on the river and catch fish and stuff. Whereas The Water is Wide is about how the river is an obstacle to you getting to the other side and, you know, meeting your love or doing something. So it's kind of like a clash of attitudes towards the water.
It's true. One is about they live their life. Their whole life comes from the water.
Yeah, and water is their joy and their happiness, where life's, comes. So
let's hear it.
Yeah.
This is one of your famous ones. This one was a huge hit at AAS, I remember.
It's really big with lots of Asian scholars.
Okay. The Water is Wide and Usuli Boat Song.
I wish to try.
Outstanding. Oh, I love that song. I could listen to that again and again and again.
I am biased, but it's a lovely song.
No, that is. It is. It's just, it's beautiful. I'm glad we finally captured it here on tape. Wow. I mean, you know, we have a little bit of time left, and I think there's nothing I would rather do than hear more music from you guys. You know, and then we can chat a little bit more on the other side, but how about at least one more song? Okay, what are we going to do?
Oh, hey. Yeah, we really need to do the one that we're going to collaborate with you guys on. Are you guys ready to collaborate with us?
Yeah, what do we have to do?
You have to, well, since you're so metal, Kaiser.
Tone deaf.
Since you're tone deaf and you're metal, I mean, just shout what you need to do here. Just
shout it like, oh, hey.
Yeah. Okay. All right. You are rocking this song about chickens.
I'm going to rock a song about chickens. Chickens bang their heads. Sort of.
Yeah. Some dark, heavy chickens.
Yeah. Okay. Some chicken metal coming your way with bluegrass and Chinese folk mixing. So tell us about this song. This is a tune I recognize. It was an old Kami song, right?
Yes. And that's also how I was raised
about chickens,
knowing the song. And of course, because since Abby and I started our pretty seriously about our dual project, and we do want to make sure of all the origins of each song we want to take as we want to go on, if we want to record it, all these issues need to be accurately documented and accurate. So so I start doing research on this one, and I found out, of course, again, someone from the party probably took the melody and added to their lyrics to praise the communist big production.
So what were the original lyrics? Well, the lyrics that you learned, I mean.
Da sheng
chan. Da sheng chan ya ma ho hey. Or.
Like great production.
Yeah.
Hey ho or whatever.
Yeah. Just all about da sheng chan. Well, there's several verses, but they're all about how great and how much we can produce in the socialist, communist, under the Communist Party's leadership. So that's just how everyone knows about this song in China. And I actually found out it's about, it's a farmer's song, chicken farmer's song, about a farmer hearing the chicken rooster sound and getting up in the morning to go to his millstone and work on the mill, in his mill. So
grind corn and grind wheat.
Yeah, so when you hear the sound, that's the sound of imitating the
millstone sound.
And
it sounds like chickens to me.
Right, well, I'm sure it's something also it's that like, too. But
Faye and I decided we really wanted to take back the song for the chickens.
Right.
So it's the chicken song. Yeah.
It's the chicken's right.
And what's the American side of the chicken song?
Well, one of the first songs you will learn often when you're learning old time Appalachian music on banjo or fiddle is a song called Cluck Old Hen. And it fits very well. Yeah.
Let's hear how well it fits. And Jeremy, here we go. Clear your throat. We're going to sing. Okay, I can safely say we ruined that one.
Yeah, well, sorry.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
That was quite a nice song until at least I started singing.
Maybe we can edit ours out. I mean, because it's actually additional beats, right? I mean, we could take it back.
Can you auto-tune my part of it? No.
It's not like T-Pain.
Oh, the perfect counterpoint.
God. Our profoundest apologies to ruining an otherwise wonderful song and having to endure that. Sorry, guys. Can we do one more? Can we hear one more song?
Yes. Well, we're going to play a good old bluegrass number here. Okay. This is one that was written by Lily Mae Ledford, and she traveled the world with her Coon Creek Girls, and they were based in East Kentucky. And so they wrote a song about traveling all over the world playing music in the 1930s. I even read somewhere that they took their Renfrew Valley barn dance all the way to Shanghai in the 1930s.
Oh my gosh.
Can you imagine? Oh my gosh. Wow. I wish I could see that.
Wow, yeah.
So we wrote all of these lyrics are their original lyrics, and
we added a Chinese lyrics at the last verse, just singing, yeah, like how we in the nowadays us want how we want to say.
Yeah,
it's a 天涯海角走一遍. Yeah, like every corner of the planet we want to take our music, and then we take our instrument and we sing 天涯海角走一遍, like travel the whole world with our music, with our instruments.
So it's literally 天涯, so it's like the banks of heavens and
海角,
the corners oceans, of the seas, the oceans, right? Yeah. To the furthest corners of the seas and to the furthest reaches of the heavens, right? So,
弹着琴我唱着歌,
while I play my instrument and while I sing 天涯海角走一遍.
Awesome. Yeah. Alright, let's hear that.
Oh, but we do lovingly call this song. We've changed the title from Banjo Pickin' Girl to Banjo Gujung Pickin' Girls.
All right. Banjo Gujung Pickin' Girls. And off we go. Bravo. That was awesome. I love that one. I love that one.
What are you up to now? What's the new thing? Because we're here in New York tomorrow night. It'll be past by the time this podcast is published. But you have a concert with some new material, and you're working on a bunch of new stuff. Can you tell us about it?
So Faye and I have been working on this hybrid of American and Chinese folk music for many years now, but we're finally intensively diving in. And this winter, we have dates set up in February to just after the Lunar New Year to get
power
started.
Power through this record.
Make a record. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a duo record that's going to be banjo, gujung, and two vocals only the whole way through.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah.
When do we expect to be able to hear this?
2018. I think
like a spring.
Well, when do I expect to be able to hear this?
Well, Kaiser, you can hear it the whole way through. You can just come down to Nashville.
I am going to do that. I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
Longtime listeners of the show, or you know, in recent weeks, you may have noticed that we've snuck a little bit of music into little parts of the show, like when we do this. I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at subchina.com. You can follow SubChina on Twitter at SubChina News and on Facebook at facebook.com/SubChinaNews. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. Guess who contributed that guzheng music you heard in the background? It was, of course, none other than Wu Fei. Thank you, Wu Fei, for giving us, you know, free music.
We're going to pay later.
Yeah. You should see the things Jeremy has to do at home.
It's not free, Kaiser.
Nothing is free. Hey, so as you guys know, we do this little thing at the end of the show where we do recommendations. And so it's usually our habit to have Jeremy kick it off, but let's have Wu Fei start us off. Give us something you've been listening to. What have you been listening to recently that you think we ought to check out?
I've been listening a lot of this composer named Gabriel Prokofiev.
Like Gabriel, Prokofiev. Like,
yeah, he's the grandson
Sergei
of
Prokofiev.
Yeah, he's his grandson.
Oh, holy shit.
Yeah, he wrote the first turntable concerto.
Turntable concerto.
Yeah, with, I think, the BBC Philharmonic.
Like,
yes.
Like,
and
scratching.
He's a brilliant composer. He's been writing a lot of string quartets, but in a really weird, funky, just a lot of attitude.
Oh, wow.
On a string quartet, so you have got to check out.
Oh, wow.
Check out
him. So what's his name?
Gabriel
Prokofiev.
Oh.
Wow. I love Prokofiev. I mean, the grandpa. He's just...
The grandson is not too shabby at all.
Oh, all right. Yeah. It's no Peter and the Wolf, though, huh?
No, but it's just that definitely the modern attitude. That family's got some attitude.
Some swag. Huh? Yeah, yeah. Definitely, definitely. Cool. Great recommendation. I'll definitely check that out. I wouldn't have thought to encounter such a thing. Abby, why don't you go next? What you got?
I just had some friends stop by for lunch who are from Scotland. They're from the Highlands, and their name as a band is Lau, L-A-U, and they are incredible. And they write, they're composers, all of them, and they play acoustic guitar, a fiddle, and accordion.
Uh-huh.
But they have pedals set up with the accordion in particular to get all kinds of pitches and different sounds and all different ranges. And they've just composed such beautiful music. They have a 17-minute piece on their new record. And then some of them are more simple folk songs. And Chris Drever, who's the lead singer, sings for the band. And it's just phenomenal music.
Oh, sounds great.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I should say my husband, Bela, just wrote a concerto for our son.
We had almost gotten through this whole podcast without mentioning the fact that you...
That's very refreshing. I do love him, and I think he's amazing. So Bela Fleck, and he wrote a beautiful concerto that's going to come out soon called the Juno Concerto after our son's name.
Oh, wow. Cool, mm-hmm. cool. Excellent. Jeremy, you're up.
I will nepotistically recommend the Wolf Force, which is another band that Abby and Faye are in, but with another friend of theirs, Kai Welch, which is a very different take on music from what we heard in this podcast. But aside from the outrageous nepotism, since this is a musical podcast, I would like to recommend the musician who's been my favorite musician since I was a teenager, Franco, the Congolese musician, Franco and the OK Jazz Band, which, if you like, just very, very long songs played on the guitar, very repetitive, but just gorgeous. Franco and Loke Jazz.
When was he active? This was in the 70s? 60s?
Late 50s to 70s.
Yeah, I mean, Congolese.
I think he died in either the late, in the maybe early 80s.
Wow, cool. That's the kind of thing that Marco Werman would recommend from, you know, PRI's The World.
Yes, I'm sure he's very familiar. Yeah, I just cheated and looked on the internet. He died in 1989.
Oh, wow, okay. I'm going to recommend music too, and it's something that's actually related to Faye. I'm going to tell a quick story here. The first time that I think we hung out and Jeremy came over, I had music on in the background, and it was a fairly obscure band from Oakland, California that had some connections to, you know, a band I played in college.
And we were all living in Beijing.
We were all living in Beijing, and I'm, you know, sitting in my apartment. And suddenly Faye turns to me and goes, is this Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum? This is Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum, right? And I went, how the hell do you know Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum? And so the whole story came out that you were friends with like Carla and with Nils and with Dan and all and Mo. And all. Yeah, oh my God, it was just crazy because, you know, these are guys that I knew in college. And, you know, wow. I mean, they're so I'm recommending the music of Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum, which is actually available on Spotify. You can hear it. Particularly the band Grand Openings and Closings. The album Grand Openings and Closings. The other ones are great too. Of Natural History is another one that I love. Check out songs like Sleep Is Wrong, which is great, and the Donkey-Headed Adversary of Humanity opens the discussion, which is just the most badass piece of music ever. There's some Zappa in them and some Mr. Bungle kind of stuff in there. It's tremendously creative music. I mean, just
very, very like, innovative.
Yeah,
yes.
There's a violinist named Carla who also does
Carla kills that. Yes,
yeah, just she's amazing.
Amazing violinist, amazing vocalist.
Yeah, she's great, and she has another band that does like sort of Balkan style music called Charming Hostess, and check them out.
And
too.
Tin Hat Trio, Tin Hat is
I know that one. Yeah. It's very good.
Yeah, all right. A very musical. Thanks so much.
Yeah, okay. Keep it going for the rest of the night.
We could, yeah. Well, I say instead we go get some Sichuan food.
Yes? Oh, yes, please.
Oh, right. Yao day.
Yao day.
Hey, so thanks, everybody. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Special thanks this week to the guy whose Airbnb we're in, whoever that is. What's his name?
James.
Hey, James. Thanks. Special thanks also to Anla Cheng, to Sarai Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at Seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/Seneca Podcast and follow us on Twitter at Seneca Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we will see you all next week. Everyone, bye.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, we should do it in harmony. Let's do it in harmony.
Bye.
I can't harmony.
What Jeremy should start.
Yeah, you start.
Yeah, I'll start.
Bye.
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 It's the seventh chord.
Bye.